Hello, and thank you for tuning in to 442 FM. We are back for a few special editions pre-World Cup. I'm joined with Kevin Ayres, the 442 editor, and Richard Bayliss, the executive producer and presenter of Opta Sport. We pod when we want. 442 FM. We pod when we want. Yeah, we've not been coming into your ears very often, but we are back for a few special issues of pod chat ahead of the World Cup. Here with a few regulars and Rich Bayliss. Thank you for joining us, mate.
No worries. Good to be here, guys.
And Kevin here, Kevin Ayres here, as always.
Kevin Hears.
And I am your bumbling host, Adam Jackson. So let's get into it. The Socceroos squad was announced last week?
Depends when you're listening, I guess.
Yes. We've Bert has announced a 32-man squad rather than a 35. Like, what does that say about him as a coach, do you think, Kev?
It's all a bit of a farce. I mean, even the 35-man squads or whatever is, you know, at the end of the day, it's all going to be, it's only 23 you're taking. So anything more than the 23 is just players you want to have a look at. And if there's no more than you want than 32 you want to look at, there's no more than 32. It's a pretty focused squad. I think there's a few big question marks over a few people. Mm. Tim Cahill being the biggest one. Will he make it? Fourth World Cup, played 65 minutes, I think it was, with Millwall in total. Got no starts, four yellow cards, and a three-match suspension. It's not a great record. It's not really the kind of record you want to your chief goal scorer to have going into the World Cup. Mm. But there is a mental fortitude and strength there that nobody else in the side has. He is a force of nature in terms of mental self-belief and just driving passion, enthusiasm, fearlessness and everything else. Mm. Whether that's misplaced or not is another matter, but he is also still our chief source of goals. And until we've got somebody else, he's in the squad for me.
Rich, I've kind of gone through this 32-man squad and I've numbered 18, which I think is, I'm pretty certain that they're going to be in there. Like, where do you kind of see, like, how many do you think places are still up for grabs out of that kind of 32?
I reckon you might have it nailed. There aren't many. Mm. Four or five, I would have said. There are a few that I've kind of caught wind that aren't necessarily in favour with Bert, but a few guys that have been there throughout the journey under Postecoglou, so hence probably the extra nine guys that he wants to have a look at. He'll, of course, cut those or cut a few of them before he gets to Turkey, which is also crucial that he wants to kind of, whether he's making a statement to a few guys that still have club commitments left, that he wants to see something from them because there are spots up for grabs, I'm not too sure. Some people have read into this squad and said that, oh no, he knows exactly what he wants to do already. Mm. I don't necessarily understand or prescribe to that line of thinking, but I would say that the core that we know of will likely always be the same. Cahill, of course, is a fascinating one, but you look at, well, who else will go? I mean, if Cahill doesn't go, who will be there that can affect the game in a way that calls upon experience and having done it at that level before? That will be central to the thinking. And interestingly, I'd sort of heard along the traps, I don't know whether it's true, but I'd heard that Bert had actually said to Tim Cahill in the camp against Colombia in London that you need to play more minutes for Millwall. And he didn't do that.
When I spoke to Bert the day he was appointed, the cocktail thing that the FFA put on that night, his one big concern was all the players that weren't getting game time. And that was just a huge worry for him. And here we are, Tim Cahill has got no game time, but he is our only source of goals. And if we don't have him in the side, look through that squad, tell me where the goals are going to come from. You know, Tommy Juric is a goal every four games striker. That's not could be any use to us whatsoever.
You see, kind of looking through the players I've left out of this 32, they're pretty much all, well, they're either fullbacks or strikers or forwards. like, in terms of that forward spot then, like, I've pretty much only tagged Juric as my only kind of bolted on forward. Well, if you don't really class Lecky as part of that forward.
Yeah, I think his forward stocks were massive, weren't they? He named quite a few. McLaren, I think, to me, he wasn't in Van Marwijk's initial squad to go and play in the friendlies against Norway and Colombia, but he did go and score a few more goals for Hibs since. They are for Hibs, and that's the antithesis to this conversation. Yeah. It's not only the fact that they're not scoring goals, it's not playing at clubs where they should be playing, and that's the argument against someone like a McLaren. But compared to a Cahill, how could you not pick him?
I think also, you know, with McLaren, yes, it's for Hibs, but that's the level he's playing at, so that's the only chance he's got to score goals. Mm. He scored 40-plus goals in two seasons in the A-League. No Australian's done anything like that before. We took Archie Thompson to World Cups with worse records. If it is a huge, huge step up, and nobody's underestimating that, from the A-League or even Scottish Premiership to the World Cup. But at the end of the day, this is a man who knows where the goal is and can put the ball in the back of the net. And frankly, that's more than almost anyone else in that position can do for us.
You wonder too about how much... Obviously, this is a short-term thing for Van Marwijk. He's come in for a very short period of time. Mm. It's get us through the group and you would have done your job. But from our perspective, as fans or supporters or guys that are following the Socceroos, there needs to be a bit of future-proofing in it as well, surely, because obviously Tim Cahill, whether he makes this World Cup, it's such a short-termist thing. Yeah. It would be a romantic story to it. If he can score it a fourth, would be remarkable. But adding a McLaren, as an example, would be beneficial, you would think, because like you say, Kev, he knows how to score and he will continue to do that down the track as well. So he'll be in the running in 4 years' time.
Yeah, definitely. I think that is a big issue, though. You know, Van Marwijk's in, he's got one objective in mind. He's not interested in the future of the Socceroos. But having said that, you know, what would Angie's squad look like? He wasn't really playing McLaren either. Mm. He was reliant on Cahill. He had almost slipped into the Verbeek and Osijek trap of relying on players over and over again, even when they stopped performing for him. So I'm not necessarily convinced it's going to be very different from what Ange would have done, apart from maybe the back three stroke back four argument. I think we've got big problems up front. Demir Petratos is another option, you know, to bring something exciting and, you know, possibly fire off some rocket from outside the box. But really, you know, goals are just going to be so hard to come by.
I'd love to know who you've left out, Adam, of that squad.
So I think the big ones I would say that I've left out is Cahill. Again,
Zani,
which is
controversial.
Yeah. Well, now these are the ones based on previous squads that I think are there. But yeah, no Naboo, no Petratos, Rukavica, Troisi out, which is, you know, he's not had the best season, but, you know, he's been part and parcel of those squads in previous years. Yeah, who would be your kind of surprise? Do you think it is going to be an Arzani? Or
I think Arzani's going to be there, and I think he will be playing off the bench. I'd be very surprised if he didn't. I think everybody says the same about him, that he's not the finished product. And he's also got stamina issues. He's not... His body isn't developed enough to be a full-time 90-minute player at that kind of level, but everybody recognises that he has got that X-factor magic off the bench that can turn games around. He can run at defences, he can upset tired players, and I think, personally, I think Bert would be mad not to take him. I think there's so many different issues with him. He would be a great surprise off the bench, and also the whole nationality claiming... Yep. And just what he brings. He would be an exciting addition from a Socceroos fans' perspective to see there. I think everybody wants to see him there.
I'm looking forward to the paranoia. If he does not get picked, and of course there are rules now which mean that you can still change nationalities if you haven't played in a competitive fixture. Even if he was to play in a friendly, for instance, but didn't go for whatever reason or didn't play in a World Cup, the paranoia around Australian football as to whether he'll still go to Iran or if he could go to Iran. I think, thankfully, from our perspective, is that he actually does not want to play for Iran. He doesn't feel connected to Iran. Mm. So hopefully those issues can be put to one side. But I tend to agree. I think we need someone in that squad as almost a point of difference. While we say a Cahill would be beneficial because he has the experience and he's a, you know, a trusted set of boots, if you like, I think Azani is kind of something different again that you could maybe call upon. Unlikely to ever start a World Cup game at this stage of his career, but maybe in the last sort of 10 or 15.
So
for me, the players that I think we desperately need to have in that squad is where a goal can come from either nothing or an unlikely source or an unlikely position on the pitch. I feel like the way that Bert has set up the, and we'll come on to kind of the kind of philosophy in a bit, is especially against Norway and Colombia, it was sitting quite deep and trying to soak up a bit of pressure, and it showed because very rare, we didn't create many chances, scored one goal in two games. That Colombia game, we looked a lot more compact, but I feel like we are going to need a goal to be, you know, a screamer from outside the box or, you know, a Cahill volley from a long field pass to actually create something in some of these games, especially France and France and Denmark, I would say.
I think the pressure on, to that point, I think the pressure on a guy like Tom Rogic, who didn't make the last World Cup through injury, he had to pull out late, but also Aaron Moy, not necessarily from goal scoring, but from creating. I think those guys who are obviously further back, they're sitting in midfield, add in yet an act from set plays, for instance. The pressure on those scenarios, I think, will be immense for us because it's very unlikely to see us, you know, creating too many clear-cut opportunities from open play.
So, in that token, do we need an out-and-out goal scorer, really, don't we?
Yes.
So we need a, like, and that's why maybe a McLaren, for me, is a player that we kind of need in this squad, that put him in the box, 12 yards out, you know, with a half a chance, he's going to make the keeper work. There's a chance he's going to score. I've got less faith in Juric in those positions.
Yeah.
You know, it was in that Norway game, was it? I think was it 1-0 or and he got put through on goal and fluffed pretty much a 1-on-1.
Well, it happened against Honduras as well, particularly in the first leg. We could have won that 2-0 quite easily, and Tommy had a couple of chances that you would hope any striker in that position would bury.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's living on borrowed time for his Socceroos spot these days, Tommy, unfortunately. But, you know, it still demands somebody else to come up and claim that spot, and that's a problem. We really are struggling. Jamie, I have a lot of faith in, and I think he has potential to be the man, but he's had a few shots already, and, you know, still to really stake his claim to the spot.
Yeah.
Until he does, it's up for grabs with anybody.
Kind of brings us nice onto Bert's philosophy and probably more so his formational kind of changes. Three at the back, he's gone.
Yes.
Long gone.
Yeah.
Nail in the coffin. Are we happy about that?
Unequivocally so.
Rich, not so much.
I at the risk of talking for half an hour about it, I sort of feel like the three at the back, or the discussion around the three at the back under Postecoglou, was a very granular discussion around something that was much bigger. Postecoglou had a philosophy, and one element of that philosophy was a change in formation based on personnel. Mm-hmm. Also based on, he actually took that from Antonio Conte when he was in charge of Italy. He saw a style of play there that he thought he could implement with the Socceroos, using the players that he had at his disposal. So one thing that I feel got lost in that whole back three discussion was the fact that there were still 11 players out there, and you always defend from the front. And yeah, there were some mistakes made, and you could argue and say that we didn't have the personnel for three centre-backs there, but I feel like that discussion kind of got a little bit out of hand. I'm not one to blame the media like Ange did. I don't necessarily agree with him on that, but I think what that was a change in formation to suit a philosophy. I think Bert, faced with the same scenario, would do the same. But given a short-term job like he has, that won't happen. He said in the press conference this week or last week or whenever it was that he would love to play football. So if he's to play football, he needs the players to do that. But then he went on to say that he's quite happy to try to grind out a result and do what is necessary to get a result, as we saw against Colombia in particular, when, as you mentioned, they were much more compact. So I think the back three's gone purely because it's a short-term thing, and he'll come in having not played that as often, and he'll go with the back four.
I think the back three was purely dogma, though, in Ange's side. You know, it was a philosophy, it was a formation that he aspired to qualifying with. And it's almost like qualifying with one hand tied behind your back. When you don't have the Italian national team quality of defence, when you don't have even three solid centre-backs, you know, we were playing converted right-backs and full-backs in those central positions, and it was guaranteed to fail. You know, it's something, it's a basic mistake you would make on Football Manager and, you know, regret and immediately change afterwards. And then it became a stubborn war of words between Ange and the media and his critics that he refused to back down on, and that's when it just got completely out of hand. And I think the media did, parts of the media did overstep the mark. I think it was a simple change that could have been implemented. Instead, it became a whole debate about Ange's future and Ange's management role, style, and everything else. And it forced him out. And I think that's really sad. I would still want to see Ange there, just with a back four.
Yeah. So based on the Norway and the Colombia game, like, what do you think we can take in terms of how Bert is going to set up that squad? I kind of touched on, I felt like he's going to sit back a little bit deeper and maybe not be as forward pressing as an Ange team would be. Rich?
Well, I think it's very opponent specific, and I think you can kind of read into a lot of what Bert said already around that. He will change based on what we're up against. Against France, you can expect it can be maybe similar to what we faced against Colombia. You worry about their midfield in particular. They have so many players in there. They have probably, we've got 32 players in a squad at the moment. They've probably got more than 32 world-class midfielders they could call on.
Yeah.
So we're not going to have much of the ball. That's just the way that game's going to go. But against a Denmark, who, I'll be honest, I'm not particularly impressed with Denmark at all. I mean, take Eriksen out of that side. They're fairly well organised, but goal threats aren't really there. So we can maybe play with a... again, you have to be quite pragmatic, but I think you can play with a little bit more freedom. We'll have more of the ball. Whereas Peru is different again. So I think it will be very much opponent-specific. But in terms of what we saw against Norway and Colombia, I reckon they'd probably just throw that Norway game out the window.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that was it was as much about individuals not turning up and playing well as it was to do with any kind of system.
Yeah, I don't think you can really draw anything from the Norway game at all, apart from the fact that it was first game under Petr van Marwijk, and that was it. In terms of how we'll play, I think it will be functional play. I don't necessarily think we're going to be particularly proud of the way that we play, but by the same token, I don't think we're going to play dirty. We've got a big feature going in the World Cup edition of 4-4-2, which is on sale next Thursday. Plug. Which has got a bumper package of World Cup Guide, World Cup Magazine, Optus Sport World Cup wall chart, stickers, trading cards, everything else. In the magazine, though, we've got a big feature, a big interview with Bert, and he is still haunted by that picture of the karate kick from the final, and he's not wanting that to be his legacy. So I think he does want Australia to go far and to play in a way that he can be proud of and people will be proud of. Mm-hmm. But by the same token, I still think it's going to be, we're going to play up the physicality that we've perhaps lacked, we've tried to avoid playing towards for the past maybe 10 years,
maybe since Germany and that kind of iteration of the squad.
Yes, yeah,
where it was a lot more maybe not. It wasn't dirty, but it was physical and athletic.
It was strong.
Yeah.
It was strong, yeah. I think we might see a bit more encouragement of that kind of attitude on the field without necessarily being karate kicks in the box.
We've certainly got the players to do it. I mean, you look at
Your
Bailey Wrights, your Milo Jedinaks, they any guys that have played in the second tier or below in English football will be certainly used to that. My question, though, on Van Marwijk not wanting his legacy to be the karate kick, how far does he need to take Australia to get that not the forefront? I mean, he's got to take us to the final, surely.
Well, yeah.
I wonder if he'll bring up the Roy O'Donovan and Thomas in the
late call-ups.
Like, it wasn't as bad as that. So warm-up games. We've got Czech Republic, 2nd of June, which the time, as far as I could see, hadn't been locked in yet. And then Hungary on the 10th of June, which leads us into the kind of opener against France. Like with these warm-up games, I think it's very loose terms, but you see that like football associations across the world will set up friendly games against teams that are similar to the teams that they're going to face in. So like I feel like the Colombia game was a little bit kind of Peru.
Yep.
Norway, in terms of geographical proximity, is similar to Denmark. I don't really know enough about Czech Republic and Hungary to know where that sits in terms of our oppositions. Like, I was a little bit underwhelmed by the standard of the opposition here. I would have felt like, especially with the opener against France, I would have wanted the Socceroos to be playing against a team that's going to take control of the game, be very take the control of the possession, and almost an opportunity for us to get back and practice that shape.
Given that Holland aren't going to the World Cup and Van Marwijk's connections, you would have thought they would have been an automatic choice to play as a friendly. If we'd been playing a friendly in Australia, I'm sure we probably would have got Holland or Italy.
Mm.
I think he doesn't even want to play these two games. These were locked in before he arrived. I think it's really just a case of he's going to go through the motions, and really it's an advanced training session for him.
Everything feels very purposeful. It feels like it's building up to the point of the opening game against France. It's very difficult to replicate what that will be like in terms of both the football and the pressure, atmosphere, everything. Obviously, if the game was in Australia, there was a farewell game. You know, the FFA would have seen to it that it was a big opponent. But he did say as well, Van Marwijk, that he doesn't really like the idea of or rate warm-up games too much. He would prefer to spend time with the players and
take them away.
It
takes 3 days out of his training schedule as far as he's concerned.
Exactly. And if you play against a big opponent, even if it's a big opponent that's not in the World Cup, you run the risk of confidence being
demoralising the squad. Yeah, absolutely.
Which, pre-2014, there were some warm-up games that did not help the confidence, I suppose, morale going in.
And it, that said, though, if you lose to Hungary, I dare say you won't go to Kazan with a great deal of confidence.
Which kind of brings us on to the easy questions, then. So, how do we beat France? Opening game.
France have a unique history in the World Cup in that they seem to have a great tournament, and you can include European Championships too. They have a great tournament, and then they have a player revolt at the next one. Then they have a great tournament. They go through waves. They really do have a dynamic ride when it comes to major tournaments. And our big hope, this sounds really defeatist, but our big hope is that they do not turn up for that first game. Mm. They will be seen as one of the favourites for the tournament, rightly so. They have an unbelievable squad. They were a little bit unlucky not to win the Euros a couple of years ago. They have been building, it seems, or it feels like, this tournament, but we need to hope that they don't start from day one. And if they have a player revolt, brilliant. That'd be nice. Because I think football-wise, you know, it's a sort of scenario where Van Marwijk himself said nine and a half times out of ten, you would expect France to beat Australia. That's probably not too far off the mark.
Yeah.
We need to hope for that 0.5 or that one out of ten where we play at our absolute best. We frustrate them in every way possible. They don't get the rub of the green in the first 30 minutes, first half. And from there, they're just frustrated to the point where we nab it.
That's ideally what I would like to see happening. Realistically, I've got a horrible feeling that we're just going to have to try and minimise the loss and hope that we don't suffer another 4-0 thrashing in the opening game that sets the mood for the rest of the competition. But, you know, we got away with that previously. We can probably do it again if we can get some decent results in the other two games. But I really do think I'm pinning my hopes on the fact that France has got so much talent, they can't pick a squad. They can't pick the team that gels properly in the first game. And it will take them a few shots of just tweaking that lineup to get it firing properly. And if we're lucky, we'll get away with the misfiring first attempt prototype.
And that has been kind of indicative of Deschamps' squads and starting 11s. In previous games, like, he really struggles, and the defence is a key area where he struggles to find the right balance. Koscielny got injured this week, is now going to be out for 6 months or so that's him out of the World Cup, which I'm not sure if that helps Deschamps, in means that he's definitely got the stronger centre backs in Varane and Umtiti. But it then takes him, it gives him maybe one less quality centre back that might cause him more issues in the kind of longer term. So I definitely think that's probably a weakness in their starting 11. What about Denmark? Again, you kind of mentioned that you weren't necessarily impressed by their squad or their kind of starting 11.
For a side that have been around the top 10 rankings, and let's not go down the rankings route because we all know that doesn't mean a great deal, but it is symbolic.
It's still quite frightening when you see their position in world football, allegedly, that we're up against.
And of the whole group.
Yeah, exactly.
In that sense. But I think for a top 12 or top 15 nation, they more than most appear to go through one player. They're a bit like a mini Portugal in that sense. I think they rely so heavily on Eriksen because he creates so much. He does a lot of work as well, and then he finishes off as well. Mm. I think you take him out of the equation, it's obviously dangerous to focus on one player and not the squad because they are quite a strong unit. But in terms of hurting you, I'm not sure they will, or I'm not sure they can. That said, I worry about how we would actually score against the Denmark. Mm. I think that's the bigger issue with them. I think if we're quite tight and we play in a way that we did against Colombia and a way that Van Marwijk clearly wants to, is prepared to play defensively, I can see us getting a clean sheet. I'm not sure I can see us scoring, though.
I think we could probably settle for a 0-0 draw there, though. I think, you know, that would not necessarily rule us out.
But it adds a lot of pressure on that last game.
Yeah.
If we did. But that's kind of looking back through some of Denmark's previous games, and they also sit, like we did in that Colombia game, around that kind of 35 to 40% possession mark. So this could be two games of two teams that are waiting for one another to attack, and they're both staying quite compact. And I suppose it will depend on the Denmark's first game against Peru as to if they've won that game, can they be a bit more adventurous and attack a bit more, which would then leave them a little bit more open in the back and doesn't not really play in the game that they play. Could we mark Eriksen out of the game? Like you mentioned, it's like a little bit risky. Kev, like could you see a Milligan just following Eriksen everywhere he goes on the pitch?
No, to be honest. I think we have more luck, rather than marking him out of the game or trying to keep him out of the game, I would just try and close him down and minimise his options. I think is where we're more likely to have success. And, you know, if we can keep him into the middle third, where he's only going to be able to fire a rocket, and just close down Bentner and the rest of them, then I think we might have more success. I think he's always going to be able to run through anything that we put up against him and find space to get the ball. I don't have an awful lot of expectation that we will be able to deny him, keep him out of the game. We just need to keep his options limited.
I think the frustration for a lot of players like that is more likely to come from that wall, if you like, that brick wall of two lines of, you know, defence and midfield that you can't get through, as opposed to being man-marked out of a game like that. Mm. He seems fairly level-headed, and obviously he deals with a lot playing for Tottenham every week, but he's not the focal point necessarily either. I tend to agree. I think we can probably just try to cut off the lines for any of these guys by putting players behind the ball, and that's likely what we'll see.
Mm. The hardest one to pick for me in the group is Peru. I feel like there's quite a nice, there's a synergy between Peru's qualification and not being in the World Cup for 32 years, and now that we're World Cup, it's like, you know, Socceroos in 2006, and could that kind of give them the hunger and the belief to actually kind of drag themselves through qualifying, where there's realistically very little pressure on them to achieve anything. They could lose all three games and it'd still be a great achievement for them to be there.
You're talking to a Scot here who not got good memories of Peru. We as a Scot in 78, we took them lightly and they thrashed us as a result. And yeah, I don't think you like you say, you know, it's a small team at the World Cup after a long absence. They're going to want to make the most of it. Mm. and go as far as they can. They will be running high on belief. Scotland were also running high in belief, but it was overconfidence rather than self-belief.
So why is it that you think that Scotland have taken a game against Peru as one of the Peruvians' warm-up games before the World Cup? Just to feel part of it again?
Just a reminder of the great days of Ali's Tartan Army.
It is interesting, though, with Peru. I think they've had some great results of late. They beat Croatia 2-0. They've beaten Iceland in the lead-up as well. They've got Scotland and Saudi Arabia, Sweden. They've got some quality opponents in there. Mm. Maybe with the exception of Saudi Arabia, that's an interesting one. Maybe they look at playing Saudi Arabia in the way that we look at playing Colombia to prepare for Peru. Maybe they think that we will be a bit like Saudi Arabia.
Asian. Well, yeah.
And, I mean, given the Asian scenario. So they're obviously done their homework, but they've had some good results. I reckon they'd be looking at this group, Peru, and thinking, we can get through this. Mm. The way they play, there are generally goals involved when they play as well. It's great to watch.
I do think it is pretty bloody open for second place in this group. I think all three outside of France are easily capable of snatching that third spot, which does make me think maybe it's going to be tedious draws amongst everybody by the end of it.
Yeah.
But I think Peru will take an attacking game, and they might well leave themselves open for us to get something. But I think they will come at us, which is going to be an interesting match.
Where do you guys see the expectation on this? I mean, obviously, you mentioned there that there's a chance that Australia can get through. Of course there is. But before the last World Cup, we went into the group of death knowing that we weren't going to go through. Mm. We conceded 3 goals in every game, played well in patches, and everyone came out proud of the achievement because we were looking longer term. This is the opposite in almost every single way. We think there's a chance of getting through the group.
Yeah.
We can see the route to getting through the group, but it's a very much a short-term project. Where do you see the expectations compared to last time?
I think... Personally, my feeling is this is kind of like the aborted World Cup. That at one stage expectations might well have been very high, and now it's just a case of let's get through this, let's get it out of the way, and we can start all over again. I don't think anybody really has high expectations of anything. If it gets to the last 16, that's a huge, huge victory. I think if Ange had been in charge, there would have been a lot of pressure on him to get to the 16. No, I don't think so, nearly as much. I think it's just a case of let's get through these games and see where we end up. I don't think anybody has expectations because they simply don't know what we're in for. You know, we don't know what Bert's going to bring, we don't know what squad he's going to choose, we don't know what these players are capable of, who's going to actually turn up because Cahill's so much on the periphery. There's a lot of randomness here. I think the nation will get behind them as they always do. It'll be a fantastic atmosphere there and at home, but in terms of expectations,
I feel like that is a an Australian view of things. But when you read outside of Australia, we're the second favourite in the group to take this. France, most people are considering them going to win all three games. But 442 in the UK have said that we'll get 4 or 6 points from this group. You know, bookies out pretty much outside of Australia are putting us second favourites for the group. I'm not sure if this is because we're much closer to the Socceroos. We've seen the issues and the struggles through the qualifying campaign, or if it's just that by nature we're pessimistic in terms of our football chances.
I think also there is a little bit of a hangover of the Arnie appointment as well. I don't think that's lifted people in any way, shape or form. Mm. It's interesting because normally when you know a new coach gets appointed, even if they're not going to take the reins immediately, there is a sort of optimism and ambition of what could be achieved. And I don't disagree with Arnie. I think he was the best Australian coach without any doubt for the job. But it really has been a dampener on the Socceroos. It was ugly the way it all happened. And I think it's really taken the shine off this World Cup campaign.
Well, why was he announced when he was? Could he have not been announced after the World Cup? Like, what if Bert takes the Socceroos to the semi-final or something like that, and they're just going to go, cheers, Bert, yep, see you later,
At the very least, why didn't they wait until the end of the season?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, let Sydney have their moment of glory and do whatever they were going to do instead of tainting it like you're losing your coach and it's all going to change next season.
I'm not sure whether it was overly thought through, but I guess Sydney FC did play a big part in that. If Sydney FC weren't to know for a longer period, you know, they've got a season that they've got to prepare for next season, even though the A-League pre-season is about 6 months long in itself. You know, from their perspective, I think they might have put the pressure on potentially Arnie to say, look, we just need to know either way. Mm-hmm. And from there, maybe the FFA thought, let's just get it out of the way early. So we can then focus.
Probably going to get leaked anyway, sort of thing. So if we.
But the thing was, it was a fait accompli. Nobody was in any doubt that that was the way it was going to go. I mean, literally, I don't think anybody had any doubts that Arnie was going to get the job. It was just a case of when was it going to be confirmed. And as such, I really think they could have at least left it until Monday, there, just after the grand final, or whenever Sydney's season finished. Mm.
Do you think we would be in the second line of betting if Arnie was our coach taking us with the same squad of players to the World Cup? How much of that do you feel is Van Marwijk?
90%.
Yeah, it's probably a very good question, very good point.
I think if Arnie had been in charge since the beginning of this campaign started, the qualifying started, then I think we might well be in second place, in all honesty.
On a local level as well.
Yeah. And I think that if he had just come in at the same time as Van Marwijk did, we would be bottom of the likely qualifiers.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. His World Cup pedigree and his CV probably puts our chances a little bit higher in kind of global.
Definitely. I mean, I think, you know, for the job that has to be done, I think he was an absolutely sterling recruitment. He was the best possible, not necessarily the best possible, but certainly realistically, he was a fantastic person to pick up for the FFA and for the Socceroos in Australia. And he is such a good bloke as well. He's very focused. He's not necessarily a bundle of laughs, but he knows what he's talking about. And if you can get him to open up, he's fascinating. And he does actually have a lot of thought and intelligent process that he's willing to explain to you, which is all in the magazine feature. Go out and buy it on Thursday. he really is. He's a very intelligent, thoughtful coach who I think is going to bring a lot. And, you know, perhaps if he did manage to get us through to the last 16 or further, we might have wanted to prolong the appointment beyond just this World Cup. Which is, again, you know, maybe we acted too soon with appointing Arnie. We've got the Asian Cup in, 7 months? Mm. It's another quick turnaround with another new coach. Just some consistency would be nice.
What are your thoughts on Arnie, Rich?
He couldn't have done any more to get the job. He simply couldn't have. I mean, particularly given that, you know, after the Central Coast, when he then went to Japan and things didn't go to plan and he was left to, you know, his career was, in a way, hanging by the balance, even though he'd had success with the Mariners. You know, he did everything he could have done at Sydney FC. They played in a way that suited the squad. He knew what he needed. He went out and got it. He signed good players from overseas. Mm. They were all good signings that bought into the club. The players there loved him. After a shaky start to Sydney FC, I think the way he turned that around is a testament to his capabilities, not only in terms of the tactical, but man management as well. He's got the credentials for the job. I think a lot of the issues come with maybe people see him as abrasive, and if you don't go for Sydney FC, you might not particularly like Arnie. I think he's great. I think he's box office. We haven't seen the best of him. You know, as everyone here knows, if you've ever spoken to Arnie or seen Arnie off TV, off camera, off microphone, he's gold. Mm. So I think if the public were more in tune with who he is as a person, I think they might have warmed to him a bit more. He comes across in a way on camera that I think doesn't always reflect his personality. But
like Aaron Merrick, in fact.
There's quite a few in that category, I guess. It's hard to tell the full story. Mm. But I think the other issue from the Australian public's perspective, rightly, was the perception of going backwards. You know, we've had Arnie before, And I think particularly when you can, not to make the comparison directly between Postecoglou and Arnold, but when you've had someone who was clearly trying to build towards something, all of a sudden it just seems like a complete turnaround in approach to kind of go back. That's the perception. I don't necessarily agree with that perception, but there are so many little subtext elements.
I think that is a very popular viewpoint in certain quarters. But I do actually also think it's unfair. Arnie, 11 years ago, very, very different coach from the Arnie today. He was a raw assistant coach thrown in at the deep end. Ridiculously high-level job for a man of his experience. And he had issues with man management. He had issues with media management. He had issues with tactics. He's learnt so much in those 11 years. And I think he is a very... It's almost like a completely different person. So I have more faith in them in that regard. I don't think it's a backward step, to be honest. I think it's just a completely new coach, as far as I'm concerned. In terms of what he achieved with Sydney, I think the most interesting and telling and possibly worrying thing is after the first season he came out and said, the biggest lesson I've learned is you can't win anything, effectively, I'm paraphrasing, with kids. And I'm going to go for experience and veterans and people who know what they're doing in future. When he had the budget for it at Sydney, and that's what he did, and that's what he brought in, and it paid off dividends. You can't do that with the Socceroos. Or we end up with the same Verbeek Osijek problem of playing the same tired old faces over and over again beyond the sell-by date. And we don't even have them anyway in the squad. We need somebody who's going to bring in youth and regenerate and keep that cycle going so that we don't get stale. And hopefully he, as I say, he's a whole new coach. Hopefully he will do that. But that is my biggest concern, that he's just going to go with tried and trusted.
But I think he has done that with Sydney. But what he's done to Josh Brillante and O'Neill in that central midfield, both of them were kind of, well, O'Neill especially was kind of almost non-existent.
Yeah.
And Brillante was struggling to kind of find his feet. And he's brought them back, made this arguably the best centre mid partnership in the A-League. And but he's managed to get these players playing and just doing the good thing, the simple things really well, and then allowing the flair players. And we do have those flair players. The likes of your Rogic and your Moy that can change games and do things for that Socceroos squad. But Arnie could bring in that and start blooding in those players from maybe plucking them from almost obscurity a little bit.
I think it's also fair to point out that, we've got this weird period at the moment where we know Graham Arnold will be the Socceroos coach, but he isn't yet. He's not allowed to talk about it. He won't want to talk about it. So he could be sitting there on a long-term plan and philosophy, and he could have all these little wells to gems in the rough and all this kind of stuff. We might not know. It's kind of hard to know. It's hard to say on evidence.
That's the thing that terrifies me about Socceroos coaches, though. They sit in an office and they've not got anything to do for like 6 months of the year, and they do come up with these plans, they come up with these strategies, and you end up with the back three. And that was Ange Postecoglou, bored in the office. What can I do that's going to be different? I'll do a back three.
Christmas tree formation.
It's funny you mention that. I saw Ange a few weeks ago in Japan. Saw him in Yokohama, and he was buzzing for the fact of having a team week to week.
Yeah.
That's a fundamental difference for a coach that's gone from club football to international or the other way. It is such a... Having the guys in every day working, particularly from a man management point of view, and sort of putting a philosophy in players' heads, the importance of that can't be understated. And also, that shows how much work Van Marwijk has to do.
Yeah.
If he's going down a different path in a short period of time before the World Cup, he has to unpick everything those guys have learnt under their previous coaches, not to mention their club coaches or managers as well. So, no small task.
Yeah.
If you may have asked him this, Ange, and you both know him well, and if you haven't, you maybe kind of speculate, like, what do you think he feels about this current kind of squad and Bert's setup of the Socceroos? Of him, like, as you kind of rightly said, he's going to be picking apart some of the what I'm sure Ange thinks was very good work and going back to basics a little bit.
Ange is very philosophical and for the most part pragmatic, apart from when it comes to tactics and strategy and formation, but I think he will just look at it and shrug, probably, and say, you know, that's him. He's the coach now. He's going to do what he thinks is best.
He would have definitely answered with a shrug if I asked that in a press conference. He would have looked daggers.
Yeah, I mean, if anyone asks that, I mean, the thing about Ange, and he admits it freely, is that he doesn't let people get close to him, you know, whether it's players, media, staffers, whoever it is.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to know. But one thing I do know about Ange, though, is that he... I think it sometimes goes beyond the team. It goes beyond the football team, and whether it's a Socceroos or a club, you know, Yokohama, whoever it is. I think, as Kev says, he's very philosophical. And I think with him, the frustration would be around that bigger picture that he was trying to implement, be it both through style of play, but also future-proofing, future planning for the Socceroos, who they are, how they take on the rest of the world. And I think that's where a lot of his frustration at the moment, if he is indeed frustrated, I'm not sure he is, but
yeah.
I think that's what he'd be thinking when he's then watching the Socceroos go out in the World Cup with a, I guess, a short-term plan.
Mm. Good stuff. I think we've done a very good first preview here. Thanks, Rich, for coming in. So I sit here and I open up my Optusport wall chart, which, as Kev rightly said, will be in the next issue of 442, June issue, on sale next week.
That's massive.
It's literally
huge.
The size of a wall. It doesn't go on the wall. It is a wall.
So, Rich, tell us about kind of your plans and kind of content strategy over the World Cup. Obviously, every single World Cup game live on Optusport. Can't get that anywhere else in Australia. What's on the cards? What can we expect?
Well, it's interesting, you know, we talk about where the Socceroos are at the moment and philosophical changes and sitting on the precipice of either a fantastic tournament where you get through the group or disappointment. I think sports broadcasting in Australia is in that sort of period at the moment as well. A lot of people don't necessarily understand an Optus coming in and taking, you know, broadcast rights. We've had the Premier League for a couple of years and that's getting bigger and bigger and starting to be quite successful. But the World Cup's something different entirely, because it's not just niche football fans, no offence to any Premier League fans, but it's everybody, the biggest sporting event in the world. You have to do it justice. And for us, this is the first time we will have done the breadth of live coverage in quite this way. We'll be live for up to 11 hours straight on a match day, which is massive, regardless of who you are. And we're pretty excited by not only the fact that we're broadcasting all 64 games, but also being able to kind of present viewers with something new, something different, you know, new faces, new approach to the way we'll broadcast live games. Everything that we do is kind of catered for every platform as well. I think one misconception around the Optus coverage is that Optus have taken football off my big screen. It's actually not the case at all. There's four or five ways you can watch on a TV or a big screen TV with us. But then to complement that, there's the small screen stuff as well, the on-the-go element, every device you have. So I guess in trying to cater for every single type of viewer, that's where we're putting a lot of our attention, because every football fan is unique.
Yeah.
You know, there aren't two of us that are the same. So that's where we want to really nail this World Cup coverage, and we plan to do so. It's making sure everybody has the experience they want.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously now as well, having said or announced that this is available for everyone, regardless of whether you're with another telco or Optus, you can get this, which is a fundamental change. And hopefully it'll go well. And I think it's a good point as well in our sort of journey to be able to show people that we're football nuts. Yeah. The people that work with me in there, I can't describe to you. It's all we talk about. We've got paraphernalia all over the place. We're talking about weird and wacky leagues of the world, the most peripheral football you can imagine we're talking about, and we're highly passionate about this. So we're going to put everything into it that we possibly can.
Just on the decision to open up to everybody, do you know what this philosophy was behind that? Because we were talking before we came on air that the Optus deal had brought in a lot of new Optus contracts. It almost seems self-defeating. It's great news for football fans, but to open it up for everybody else, what was the thought behind that?
I guess there was a lot of sort of looking at or analysis on how the original deal came about, and I wouldn't go as far as saying that it was an admission that maybe it wasn't right, but I think it's just pivoting on a strategy and appreciating the World Cup as a tournament. because we know the World Cup is not just about football fans. That, you know, non-football fans, even non-sporting fans, sometimes, you know, buy into this tournament because of the narrative, the colour, atmosphere, everything around it. So I think you need to sort of read that tournament and say, well, you know, we're the only ones providing all 64 games. Maybe we should open this up to everybody because everybody wants to be a part of it. In terms of a business strategy, that's kind of outside of my realm, but I think Optus are pretty comfortable in the way things have gone so far. As you mentioned, you know, accounts are up and more people are coming to Optus, which is great. But we really want to kind of show people and get it in front of more people what we're doing and sort of flex our muscle in that sense, because, you know, you have to kind of adapt as things move. And that was a good strategy 2 years ago, and they've decided, I say they, you know, they, we, Optus, who have decided that, you know, we're going to go a slightly different direction. And so far, the reaction to that's been really positive.
So you've got the World Cup, you've got the EPL, you've got cricket?
No, no longer have cricket.
Oh, you don't have cricket anymore. No. Sorry, that's right. Where next? What's next?
There are a few things on the horizon. I think if you dig deep enough, you will see our CEO, who's a massive football nut. He actually... The crazy thing was, when he announced that we got the Premier League again, he is a massive Arsenal fan, Alan Liu, and he dropped a little criticism of all players, Mohamed Elneny, in the press conference to announce Premier League. And
I was there, actually. I was just sat in the ground going, a couple of digs at Arsene Wenger, Elneny. Yeah.
I said to him later on, I said, listen, I don't know CEOs that would drop a casual Mohamed Elneny. He loves it. And that's actually a really good thing for us as football fans as well, because you know that the people pulling the strings, if you like, are the same. So it's kind of, I think from that perspective, you know, having someone like him at the helm who is passionate about growing it is good for football fans, because he'll go and get, or try to get, or be in the conversation with competitions that we love. And he's actually said on record in a couple of places a few of the competitions that we're after. Although I think he's no longer saying that, because it's something he might have got to slap over the wrists. But there are some high quality football tournaments out there and competitions that we're looking at, because I think when you look at Premier League, obviously World Cup, that's the upper echelon of football, and you know, you have to get things to match that.
So Champions League,
well, I believe that's available at some point soon. I think that the bidding for that will start quite soon,
right.
Whether or not that's something we can get, love that to be the case, to obviously complement what we have already.
Talking about the best of the best, yeah.
Exactly, yeah, and on the back of the World Cup as well. I mean, the great thing for us, you know, I've followed just about every league in Europe for as long as I can remember. We don't want to just be pigeonholed into one league or one competition. Like, we talk about other leagues anyway, so we'll grab that opportunity with both hands if other competitions do come up, and hopefully the viewers, many of whom will be joining us for the first time during the World Cup, you know, hopefully they will jump on board and say, hey, this is actually pretty good, and I'm confident they will.
The one thing, looking at this war chart now, and there's like a little asterisk on all the games that are kind of group games that are just showed on Optus, the big one for me is Group A, and as a big Mo Salah fan, like, every single Egypt game is only available to watch on Optus Sport. Like, surely that's going to have Liverpool fans tuning in thousands to see how he goes on at the big stage.
I think the other one that gets my attention is every single Group D game is exclusive to Optus.
Yeah,
so it's Argentina, Iceland,
Croatia,
and best strip in the competition, Nigeria.
Yeah,
yeah, big time, big time.
Oh, I think Peru would have an issue with that.
Second best.
Where do you rank ours? Have you ranked the Australian one?
It's very low. Very low.
We'll stick to the top two. Well, that's a good point, actually, with Messi.
Oh,
obviously, Messi, the only place to see him.
Yep.
You know, in his probably, surely, final quest to lift that trophy in the group stage will be on Optus Sport.
A lot of Croatian fans in Australia as well who will be keen to watch that.
Absolutely.
Those games. And England, Belgium, exclusive to Optus, which is... surprising that wasn't picked up as a match of the day.
Yeah.
Well, I think maybe you can look at that and say that, and certainly the confident England fans, and there are always a few confident ones when the World Cup comes around.
There is not one here.
55 million of them, actually.
That's right. Replace confident with delusional, potentially, mate. You know, they could look at that and go, well, actually, surely the group will be done by that, and then we'll have played Tunisia and Panama. Each team will be on 6 points. Maybe that's essentially a friendly, but you don't it really pans out that way.
It's not going to be the case for England.
Even if it isn't a done deal, I mean, you're going to see, that's going to be a classic match, I think, anyway.
Well, I mean, is it the World Cup game with the most Premier League players in it in
history?
That's
a good call, actually. Surely. That's a very good call. Yeah.
Apart from two or three Belgian starters that you would imagine, I think pretty much everyone's in the Premier League.
Yeah, that's a good call.
That is a very good point. Yeah, I've still not forgiven England for the Euros. I saw we got Iceland as a draw. I bought tickets for the quarterfinal in Paris. Booked my flights. It was my dad's 60th birthday. I was like, Dad, I've got a treat for you. We're going to go to a quarterfinal in Paris, probably against France, and it's looking likely it's going to be England. And obviously, we all know what happened there.
Did you go?
I still went. Do you know what? France was so good in that tournament. If England were there, we probably would have been beaten, the 4-2 scoreline that Iceland got beat. So actually being there as a neutral and just enjoying the game and the atmosphere, and it was absolutely phenomenal. It was like it was the highest kind of level game that I've been to. I've never been to like a semi or a final of a Euros or anything, and it was just absolutely packed, full of French, really in good voice. Iceland fans are obviously the highlight of the tournament in terms of fans, followed maybe closely by Ireland. It was a great experience. But yeah,
you say we when you talk about Australia, and we when you talk about England.
Yeah, I've dual nation. Yeah. So my love for the Socceroos came from 2006, and this was before moving to Australia was a kind of twinkle in my eye, and ended up landing in Stuttgart when it was England versus Sweden, I think, and then it was the Australia-Croatia. And yeah, couldn't get England tickets. And then I was camping with these Aussie guys, and they were like, oh, well, we're going to the game. I think there are still tickets available. Try and get some tickets. And I did. And it was the Croatia game, which was just unbelievable. And that just kind of sparked my love and went up and went to the game again for the Italy game and was left deflated as much as it was if it was England. And then ever since then, they've been my second team.
It's funny you mentioned that Croatia game. We obviously have Mark Schwarzer on our books for the World Cup. We've had him for the Premier League coverage as well, and he'll be central to what we're doing with our analysts and pundits during the World Cup. Mm. And he tells a great story around that Croatian match because, of course, he was dropped. Željko Kalats came in, Husidink, and brought him in for that third group game.
Yeah.
And Graham Pohl, referee, who went down in history because of what he did later on in that
three
match.
Yellows.
Was jogging past Schwarzer as he was warming up with Ante Kovic on the sideline. And Graham Pohl, of course, knew Schwarzer quite well from his time in the Premier League. And Mark just kind of said, oh, hi, Graham, how are you? And Graham, oh, not playing, are we, Mark? Dropped. And then ran off. So there's actually, keep an eye out. We've got Mark talking about that sort of in depth. And obviously, then seeing him show three yellow cards to one player and disallow a goal on full time that was 100% a goal.
Yeah.
We should have won that game 3-2. I think Mark was quite happy with the fact that Graham Pohl was in the headlines after that.
I in my head, the game was finished 3-2. I still believe it to be like, and when I'm talking about the game, it's like, oh, and 3-2, awesome game. And I'm like, I didn't. It finished 2-2. And I was like, oh, yeah, that goes this way, doesn't it? I just kind of got it in my memory that it was. You know, I was probably quite drunk on Bavarian beer at that point. But, yeah.
I just remember walking down George Street after that. We were at the, Shelbourne? Shelbourne, that's it. Walking down George Street. And there was just a mass of Socceroos fans. And it was like we were in Germany.
Yeah.
It was that busy. And just everyone celebrating, stopping the traffic. People having breakfast, and yeah, it's fantastic. What a day. That was great.
Good stuff. Well, let's leave it there. We will hopefully be recording a few more World Cup pods, and then Kev is going to pick up the term? Pick up the mantle? Is that the...
Yep.
And take it over to Russia when he'll be over there and record a few pods from Kazan or wherever the Socceroos take him.
Wherever we find ourselves.
All the way to Moscow for the final.
Exactly. Bound to happen.
Thank you to Richard Bayliss, Sports, for coming in today. We may get a chance to speak to you again before you're heading over to Russia as well.
Yep, I'll be in Moscow. I've got the pleasure of hosting a show over there called Red Square Live, which Australian time 6:30 every morning. So, If you don't want to stay up and watch Tunisia Panama for whatever weird reason, obviously,
why would you miss that?
Well, that's my point exactly. But wake up every morning and see my melon along with some special guests from the world of football too. So looking forward to everything that Moscow and Russia more broadly has to offer.
Mel's on your team as well this year.
Mel McLaughlin will be hosting. She's one of our hosts along with Jules Breach, who's someone that our Premier League viewers will be familiar with, hosts the Fantasy Show and also works for BT Sport in the UK. So we're actually, next week we'll announce a whole list of pundits as well that will join us, and there are over 500 international caps worth in that list, so we're pretty excited by that.
Good Lord. Mm. Mind you, Schwartz is about 300 of those,
isn't he? he's 485
of them. Lovely stuff. Thanks, Kev.
Cheers.
I've been your host, Adam, and we'll speak to you again maybe next week.